Ruther turned away. One, shall I smite them? No. Two, I could make them as dust, just say the word. No, that's worse than war. Three, but you said a god must protect his people. What would we be if I told you to crush honest men? Four, not stuck full of arrows? No. The Omnians were assembling among the dunes. A lot of them had clustered around the iron-shielded cart. Brother looked at it through a mist of despair. "Didn't I say go down there alone?" he said. Simony, who was leaning against the turtle, gave him a grim smile. "Did it work?" he said. "I think it didn't." "I knew it. Sorry you had to find out. Things have a way of wanting to happen, see? Sometimes you get people facing off, and that's it."
But if only people would...
Yeah, you could use that as a commandment. There was a clanging noise and a hatch opened on the side of the turtle. Urn emerged, backwards, holding a spanner.
What is this thing? Said Brother.
It's a machine for fighting, said Simony. The turtle moves, eh?
For fighting Ephebians, said Brother.
Urn turned around.
What?
He said.
You've built this thing to fight Ephebians?
Well, no, said Urn, looking bewildered. We're fighting Ephebians.
Everyone, said Simony.
But I never... Brother looked at the spiked wheels and the saw-edged plates around the edge of the turtle.
It's a device that goes by itself, said Urn. We were going to use it for... I mean, look, I never wanted it to...
We need it now, said Simony.
Which we?
What comes out of the big long spout thing at the front, said Brother.
Steam, said Urn dully. It's connected to the safety valve.
Oh.
It comes out very hot, said Urn, sagging even more.
Oh?
Scalding, in fact.
Brother's gaze drifted from the steam funnel to the rotating knives.
Very philosophical, he said. We were going to use it against Vorbis, said Urn.
And now you're not. It's going to be used against Ephebians. You know, I used to think I was stupid, and then I met philosophers.
Simony broke the silence by patting Brother on the shoulder.
It will all work out, he said. We won't lose. After all, he smiled encouragingly, we have God on our side.
Brother turned. His fist shot out. It wasn't a scientific blow, but it was hard enough to spin Simony around.
He clutched his chin. What was that for? Isn't this what you wanted?
We get the gods we deserve, said Brother, and I think we don't deserve any.
Stupid, stupid.
The sanest man I've met this year lives up a pole in the desert.
Stupid, I think I ought to join him.
One. Why?
Gods and men and gods, said Brother. Everything happens because things have happened before.
Stupid.
Two. But you are the chosen one.
Choose someone else.
Brother strode off through the ragged army. No one tried to stop him. He reached the path that led up to the cliffs and did not even turn to look at the battle lines.
Aren't you going to watch the battle? I need someone to watch the battle.
Didactylos was sitting on a rock, his hands folded on his stick.
Oh, hello, said Brother bitterly. Welcome to Omnia.
It helps if you're philosophical about it, said Didactylos.
But there's no reason to fight.
Yes, there is. Honour and revenge and duty and, well, things like that.
Do you really think so?
I thought philosophers were supposed to be logical.
Didactylos shrugged.
Well, the way I see it, logic is only a way of being ignorant by numbers.
I thought it would all be over when Vorbis was dead.
Didactylos stared into his inner world.
It takes a long time for people like Vorbis to die. They leave echoes in history.
I know what you mean.
How's Urn's steam machine? Said Didactylos.
I think he's a bit upset about it, said Brother.
Didactylos cackled and banged his stick on the ground.
He's learning. Everything works both ways.
It should do, said Brother.
Something like a golden comet sped across the sky of the Discworld. Om soared like an eagle, buoyed up by the freshness, by the strength of the belief. For as long as it lasted, anyway. Belief this hot, this desperate, never lasted long. Human minds could not sustain it, but while it did last, he was strong. The central spire of Cori Celesti rises up from the mountains at the hub, 10 vertical miles of green ice and snow, topped by the turrets and domes of Dun Manifesting. There the gods of the Discworld live. At the least, any god who is anybody. And it is strange that although it takes years of effort and work and scheming for a god to get there, once there they never seem to do a lot apart from drink too much and indulge in a little mild corruption. Many systems of government follow the same broad lines. They play games. They tend to be very simple games because gods are easily bored by complicated things. It is strange that while small gods can have one aim in mind for millions of years, are, in fact, one aim, large gods seem to have the attention span of the common mosquito. And style? If the gods of the Discworld were people, they would think that three plastered ducks is a bit avant-garde. There was a double door at the end of the main hall. It rocked to a thunderous knocking. The gods looked up vaguely from their various preoccupations, shrugged and turned away. The doors burst inward. Om strode through the debris, looking around with the air of one who has a search to complete and not a lot of time to do it in. "Right," he said. Io, god of thunder, looked up from his throne and waved his hammer threateningly. "Who are you?" Om strode towards the throne, picked up Io by his toga, and gave a quick jab with his forehead. Hardly anyone really believes in thunder gods anymore.
"How?" "Listen, friend, I've got no time for talking to some panty waster in a sheet. Where's the gods of Ifeb and Tassort?"
Io, clutching at his nose, waved vaguely towards the centre of the hall.
"You didn't have to do that,"
he said reproachfully. Om strode across the hall. In the centre of the room was what at first looked like a round table, and then looked like a model of the Discworld, turtle, elephants and all, and then, in some undefinable way, looked like the real Discworld, seen from far off, yet brought up close to. There was something subtly wrong about the distances, a feeling of vast space curled up small. But possibly the real Discworld wasn't covered with a network of glowing lines hovering just above the surface, or perhaps miles above the surface. Om hadn't seen this before, but he knew what it was. Both a wave and a particle, both a map and the place mapped. If he focused on the tiny glittering dome on top of the tiny Cori Celesti, he would undoubtedly see himself looking down on an even smaller model, and so on, down to the point where the universe coiled up like the tail of an ammonite, a kind of creature that lived millions of years ago and never believed in any gods at all. The gods clustered around it, watching intently. Om elbowed aside a minor goddess of plenty. There were dice floating just above the world, and a mess of little clay figures and gaming counters. You didn't need to be even slightly omnipotent to know what was going on.
"He hit my nose."
Om turned around.
"I never forget a face, friend. Just take yours away, right? While you still have some left."
He turned back to the game.
"Excuse me,"
said a voice by his waist. He looked down at a very large newt.
"Yes?" "You're not supposed to do that here. No smiting, not up here. Eat the rules. You won't fight, you get your humans fight his humans."
"Who are you?"
"Patang, patang, me."
"You're a god?"
"Definite."
"Yeah? How many worshippers have you got?"
51.
The newt looked at him hopefully and added,
"Is that lots? Can't count."
It pointed at a rather crudely moulded figure on the beach in Omnia and said,
"But got a stake?"
Om looked at the figure of the little fisherman.
"When he dies, you'll have 50 worshippers," he said.
"That more or less than 51?
"A lot less."
"Definite?"
"Yes."
"No one tell me that."
There were several dozen gods watching the beach. Om vaguely remembered the Ephebian statues. There was the goddess with the badly carved owl, yes? Om rubbed his head. This wasn't godlike thinking. It seemed simpler when you were up here. It was all a game. You forgot that it wasn't a game down there. People died. Bits got chopped off. We're like eagles up here, he thought. Sometimes we show a tortoise how to fly, then we let go. He said to the occult world in general, there's people gonna die down there. A Tsortian god of the sun did not even bother to look round.
That's what they're for, he said. In his hand he was holding a dice box that looked very much like a human skull, with rubies in the eye sockets.
Ah, yes, said Om. I forgot that for a moment.
He looked at the skull and then turned to the little goddess of plenty.
What's this, love? A cornucopia? Can I have a look? Thanks.
Om emptied some of the fruit out. Then he nudged the newt god.
If I was you, friend, I'd find something long and hefty, he said. Is one less than 51?
Said Patang Patang.
It's the same, said Om firmly.
He eyed the back of the Tsortian god's head.
But you have thousands, said the newt god. You fight for thousands.
Om rubbed his forehead. I spent too long down there, he thought. I can't stop thinking at ground level.
I think, he said, I think if you want thousands, you have to fight for one.
He tapped the solar god on the shoulder.
Hey, sunshine.
When the god looked around, Om broke the cornucopia over his head. It wasn't a normal thunderclap. It stuttered like the shyness of supernovas, great ripping billows of sound that tore up the sky. Sand fountained up and whirled across the recumbent bodies lying face down on the beach. Lightning stabbed down, and sympathetic fire leapt from spear tip and sword point. Simony looked up at the booming darkness.
What the hell's happening?
He nudged the body next to him. It was Argavisti. They stared at one another. More thunder smashed across the sky. Waves climbed up one another to rip into the fleet. Hull drifted with awful grace into hull, giving the baseline of the thunder a counterpoint of groaning wood. A broken spar thudded into the sand by Simon's head.
We're dead if we stay here, he said. Come on.
They staggered through the spray and sand, amidst groups of cowering and praying soldiers, fetching up against something hard, half covered. They crawled into the calm under the turtle. Other people had already had the same idea. Shadowy figures sat or sprawled in the darkness. Ern sat dejectedly on his toolbox. There was a hint of gutted fish.
The gods are angry, said Borvorius.
Bloody furious, said Argavisti.
I'm not that happy myself, said Simony. Gods, eh?
This is no time for impiety, said Ram Ap Ifan.
There was a shower of grapes outside.
Can't think of a better one, said Simony.
A piece of cornucopia shrapnel bounced off the roof of the turtle, which rocked on its spiked wheels.
But why be angry with us? Said Argavisti. We're doing what they want.
Borvorius tried to smile.
Gods, eh? He said. Can't live with them. Can't live without them.
Someone nudged Simony and passed him a soggy cigarette. It was a Tsortian soldier. Despite himself, he took a puff.
It's good tobacco, he said. The stuff we grow tastes like a camel's droppings.
He passed it along to the next hunched figure.
Thank you.
Borvorius produced a flask from somewhere.
Will you go to hell if you have a drop of spirit? He said. So it seems, said Simony absently.
Then he noticed the flask.
Oh, you mean alcohol? Probably, but who cares? I won't be able to get near the fire for priests. Thanks. Pass it round. Thank you.
The turtle rocked to a thunderbolt.
Ding, ying, ham, yong, bong.
They all looked at the pieces of raw fish and Faster Benji's hopeful expression.
I could rake some of the coals out of the firebox from here, said Ern after a while.
Someone tapped Simony on the shoulder, creating a strange tingling sensation.
Thank you. I have to go.
As he took it, he was aware of the rush of air, a sudden breath in the universe. He looked around in time to see a wave lift a ship out of the water and smash it against the dunes. A distant scream coloured the wind. The soldiers stared.
There were people under there, said Argavisti.
Simony dropped the flask.
Come on, he said.
And no one, as they hauled on timbers in the teeth of the gale, as Erne applied everything he knew about levers, as they used their helmets as shovels to dig under the wreckage, asked who it was they were digging for, or what kind of uniform they'd been wearing. Fog rolled in on the wind, hot and flashing with electricity, and still the sea pounded down. Simony hauled on a spar, and then found the weight lessen as someone grasped the other end. He looked up into Brother's eyes.
"Don't say anything," said Brother. "Gods are doing this to us."
"Don't say anything.
I've got to know. It's better than us doing this to us, isn't it? There are still people who never got off the ships. No one ever said it was going to be nice."
Simony pulled aside some planking. There was a man there, armour and leathers so stained as to be unrecognisable, but alive.
"Listen," said Simony as the wind whipped at him. "I'm not giving in. You haven't won. I'm not doing this for any sort of god, whether they exist or not. I'm doing it for other people. And stop smiling like that."
A couple of dice dropped onto the sand. They sparkled and crackled for a while and then evaporated. The sea calmed. The fog went ragged and curled into nothingness. There was still a haze in the air, but the sun was at least visible again, if only as a brighter area in the dome of the sky. Once again, there was the sensation of the universe drawing breath. The gods appeared, transparent and shimmering, in and out of focus. The sun glinted off a hint of golden curls and wings and lyres. When they spoke in unison, their voices drifting ahead or trailing behind the others, as always happens when a group of people are trying to faithfully repeat something they've been told to say. Om was in the throng, standing right behind the Tsortean god of thunder, with a faraway expression on his face. It was noticeable, if only to Brother, that the thunder god's right arm disappeared behind his own back in a way that, if such a thing could be imagined, would suggest that someone was twisting it to the edge of pain. What the gods said was heard by each combatant in his own language, and according to his own understanding. It boiled down to, 1, this is not a game, 2, here and now, you are alive. And then it was over.
"You'd make a good bishop," said Brother.
"Me?" said Didactylos. "I'm a philosopher."
"Good. It's about time we had one."
"And an Ephebian."
"Good. You can think up a better way of ruling the country. Priests shouldn't do it. They can't think about it properly, nor can soldiers."
"Thank you," said Simony.
They were sitting in the Cenobiarch's garden. Far overhead, an eagle circled, looking for anything that wasn't a tortoise.
"I like the idea of democracy. You have to have someone everyone distrusts," said Brother. "That way everyone's happy."
"Think about it. Simony?"
"Yes. I'm making you head of the Quisition."
"What?"
"I want it stopped, and I want it stopped the hard way."
"You want me to kill all the Inquisitors, right?"
"No, that's the easy way. I want as few deaths as possible. Those who enjoyed it, perhaps, but only those. Now, where's Erne?"
The moving turtle was still on the beach, wheels buried in the sand, blown about by the storm. Erne had been too embarrassed to try to unearth it.
"The last I saw, he was tinkering with the door mechanism," said Didactylos. "Never happier than when he's tinkering with things."
"Yes, we shall have to find things to keep him occupied. Irrigation, architecture, that sort of thing."
"And what are you going to do?" said Simony.
"I've got to copy out the library," said Brother.
"But you can't read and write," said Didactylos.
"No, but I can see and draw. 2 copies, 1 to keep here. Plenty of room when we burn the Septuagint," said Simony.
"No burning of anything."
"You have to take a step at a time," said Brother.
He looked out at the shimmering line of the desert. Funny, he'd been as happy as he'd ever been in the desert.
"And then," he began.
"Yes?"
Brother lowered his eyes to the farmlands and villages around the citadel. He sighed.
"And then we'd better get on with things," he said. "Every day."
Fasta Benj rode home in a thoughtful frame of mind. It had been a very good few days. He'd met a lot of new people and sold quite a lot of fish. Patang Patang, with his lesser servants, had talked personally to him, making him promise not to wage war on some place he'd never heard of. He'd agreed. Fastabenge's people had no word for war, since they had no one to fight and life was quite tough enough as it was. Patang Patang's words had arrived as, "Remember when Pacha Moj hit his uncle with the big rock? Like that, only more worse." Some of the new people had shown him this amazing way of making lightning. You hit this rock with this piece of hard stuff, and you got little bits of lightning which dropped onto dry stuff, which got red and hot like the sun. If you put more wood on it, it got bigger, and if you put a fish on, it got black. But if you were quick, it didn't get black, but got brown and tasted better than anything he'd ever tasted, although this was not difficult. And he'd been given some knives, not made out of rock and cloth, not made out of reeds, and all in all, life was looking up for Fastabenge and his people. He wasn't sure why lots of people would want to hit Pacha Modge's uncle with a big rock, but it definitely escalated the pace of technological progress. No one, not even Brother, noticed that old Lutse wasn't around anymore. Not being noticed either as being present or absent is part of a history monk's stock in trade. In fact, he'd packed his broom and his bonsai mountains and had gone by secret tunnels and devious means to the hidden valley in the central peaks where the abbot was waiting for him. The abbot was playing chess in the long gallery that overlooked the valleys. Fountains bubbled in the gardens and swallows flew in and out of the windows.
"All went well," said the abbot without looking up.
"Very well, lord," said Lutse. "I had to notch things a little, though."
"I wish you wouldn't do that sort of thing," said the abbot, fingering a pawn. "You'll overstep the mark one day."
"It's the history we've got these days," said Lutse. "Very shoddy stuff, lord. I have to patch it up all the time."
"Yes, yes.
We used to get much better history in the old days."
"Things were always better than they are now. It's in the nature of things."
"Yes, lord."
"Lord,"
the abbot looked up in mild exasperation,
"you know the books say that Brother died and there was a century of terrible warfare?"
"You know my eyesight isn't what it was, Lutse."
"Well, it's not entirely like that now."
"Just so long as it all turns out all right in the end," said the abbot.
"Yes, lord," said the history monk.
"There are a few weeks before your next assignment. Why don't you have a little rest?"
"Thank you, lord. I thought I might go down to the forest and watch a few falling trees."
"Good practice, good practice. Mind always on the job, eh?"
As Lutse left, the abbot glanced up at his opponent.
"Good man, that," he said. "Your move."
The opponent looked long and hard at the board. The abbot waited to see what long-term devious strategies were being evolved. Then his opponent tapped a piece with a bony finger.
"Remind me again," he said, "how the little horse-shaped ones move."
Eventually, Brother died, in unusual circumstances. He had reached a great age, but this at least was not unusual in the church. As he said, you had to keep busy every day. He rose at dawn and wandered over to the window. He liked to watch the sunrise. They hadn't got around to replacing the temple doors. Apart from anything else, even Urn hadn't been able to think of a way of removing the weirdly contorted heap of molten metal. So they'd just built steps over them. And after a year or two, people had quite accepted it, and said it was probably a symbol. Not of anything exactly, but still a symbol. Definitely symbolic. But the sun did shine off the copper dome of the library. Brother made a mental note to inquire about the progress of the new wing. There were too many complaints about overcrowding these days. People came from everywhere to visit the library. It was the biggest non-magical library in the world. Half the philosophers of Ifeb seemed to live there now, and Omnia was even producing one or two of its own. And even priests were coming to spend some time in it because of the collection of religious books. There were 1,283 religious books in there now, each one, according to itself, the only book any man need ever read. It was sort of nice to see them all together. As Didactylos used to say, you had to laugh. It was while Brother was eating his breakfast that the subdeacon, whose job it was to read him his appointments for the day and tactfully make sure he wasn't wearing his underpants on the outside, shyly offered him congratulations. "Hm?" said Brother, his gruel dripping off the spoon.
100 years, said the subdeacon, "since you walked in the desert, sir."
"Really? I thought it was 50 years.
"'Can't be more than 60 years, boy.'
100 years, Lord. We had a look in the records.'
"'Really? 100 years? 100 years' time?'
Brother laid down his spoon very carefully and stared at the plain white wall opposite him. The subdeacon found himself turning to see what it was the cenobiarch was looking at, but there was nothing, only the whiteness of the wall.
100 years, mused Brother. Good Lord, I forgot, he laughed. I forgot. 100 years, eh? But here and now, the
subdeacon turned around.
Cenobiarch?
He stepped closer, the blood draining from his face.
Lord?
He turned and ran for help. Brother's body toppled forward, almost gracefully smacking into the table. The bowl overturned, and gruel dripped onto the floor. And then Brother stood up without a second glance at his corpse.
"Ah! I wasn't expecting you," he said.
Death stopped, leaning against the wall.
"How fortunate you were!"
"But there's still such a lot to be done."
"Yes, there always is."
Brother followed the gaunt figure through the wall, where instead of the privy that occupied the far side in normal space, there was black sand. The light was brilliant, crystalline, in a black sky filled with stars.
"Ah, there really is a desert."
"Does everyone get this?" said Brother.
"Who knows?"
"And what is at the end of the desert?"
"Judgment."
Brother considered this.
"Which end?"
Death grinned and stepped aside. What Brother had thought was a rock in the sand was a hunched figure sitting clutching its knees. It looked paralysed with fear. He stared.
"Vorbis?"
he said. He looked at Death.
"But Vorbis died 100 years ago."
"Yes, he had to walk it all alone. All alone with himself, if he dared."
"He's been here for 100 years?
"Possibly not. Time is different here. It is more personal."
"Ah, you mean 100 years can pass like a few seconds?"
100 years can pass like infinity."
The black-on-black eyes stared imploringly at Brother, who reached out automatically without thinking, and then hesitated.
"He was a murderer," said Death. "And a creator of murderers, a torturer without passion, cruel, callous, compassionless."
"Yes, I know. He's Vorbis," said Brother.
Vorbis changed people. Sometimes he changed them into dead people, but he always changed them. That was his triumph. He sighed. "But I'm me," he said. Vorbis stood up uncertainly and followed Brother across the desert. Death watched them walk away. That is the end of Small Gods, written by Terry Pratchett, and it was read by Nigel Planer.